it's Fern here, popping in quickly before the show because I really want to hear from you. I am forever grateful to you every single time you press play on an episode of Happy Place. And this show really is for you. So in the interest of doing more stuff that you love and less of the stuff you're not bothered by, I would love it if you took a couple of minutes to fill out a little survey for me. The link will be in the show notes. Your input on the content and the format and the guests and all those types of things is so important to help me and the Happy Place team shape the future of Happy Place. So just click on the link in the show notes to share all your thoughts and musings. I appreciate you loads. Hello and welcome to Happy Place with me, Fern Cotton. This is the show that acknowledges life's highs, its lows and everything in between. Today, I'm chatting to Gabby Logan.
I was trying to be kind of positive and seize the day in lots of ways, you know, making myself busy, doing everything I could to kind of have a full and great life that I was living, rushing through life, but at the same time, not really connecting with things, you know. So I think if you rush, you don't necessarily see things, you don't necessarily breathe, you don't take things in. And so it's probably a couple of years without breathing.
Gabby's been a much loved fixture on our TVs for over 25 years. But behind the exciting exterior of presenting the Olympics and hosting her own incredibly popular podcast, there's been real tragedy and grief. She's written a book, The First Half, oh my God, I love this book, which details everything from the difficulties of coping with her father's alcoholism to the hilarious sliding doors moment that saw her meeting her husband, Kenny. Gabby came round to mine over the summer. Oh my God, it was so freaking hot. I can't even describe how hot it was. I'd encourage you to cast your mind back to the extreme heat waves we were experiencing. Imagine it, but in a small airtight room, which is this tiny shed studio I have in the garden. It was so sweaty. We stood up and we were dripping, quite frankly. It was horrific. Anyway, I thought I'd tell you that just so you could feel sorry for us.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Right, let's do it. Here's the show. Gabby Logan, who currently looking at this terribly bound copy of your amazing book. I was lucky enough to get an early preview, but it's obviously the one where it's not all laminated.
It looks like somebody sellotaped it together for you.
They have. But I'm so lucky to have had an early copy and I loved reading it. I loved it. And we're going to talk about that in a moment. But first of all, how are you?
I'm very well. Yeah, very well. It's been a busy summer of sport.
Yes.
And it's going to continue all the way through because we've got the World Cup coming up as well. So it's just, you know, it just rolls on and on.
I mean, are you still buzzing from the Euros? Because that was just the most phenomenal moment.
It was, and it was unexpected in a way. I don't mean that their success was unexpected, but at the beginning of it, people would say to me, do you think they can win? And, well, yeah, I think they can win. You know, whether they do is another thing. But what was unexpected was the reaction. It was just so joyous and how people really embraced it. And the atmosphere in the stadiums all the way through was incredible. I'd come out into the, you know, the street outside waiting to kind of get into a car to go home, and I didn't want to leave because people were just loving it. And that's not the case when you go to a lot of other football matches, you know. Mm-hmm. And think back to last summer's men's Euros, that definitely wasn't the case. So all the way through there was this lovely feeling of kind of togetherness and people enjoying the performances. And then to cap it all off, that dramatic final and what those Lionesses did, I just think it was one of the great moments in sport, really. Never mind women's sport, never mind football.
No, it was the greatest. I wept. I wept watching when the Lionesses were sort of running around the pitch and celebrating, and you could feel that euphoria. I had this really unexpected sort of visceral reaction to it where I was weeping, but I sort of felt it in my bones for women and like the women in my ancestry and this feeling. And I had to really like sit and try and process it after, because I'm not a massive sort of dedicated football fan. I'll watch the big matches like many people out there and get carried away with that and the unity that that brings. But I felt this in my bones for women, because it was like everybody was looking at women for the right reason. It wasn't about what they look like or judging them or their intellect. It was, these women have trained so hard and all of that work has paid off, and this is their moment for us to just watch them.
To add to that as well, in a totally, you know, concur with what you're saying, is also the DNA, the history of those women. You know, some of those women that 50 years ago couldn't play the game, mm-hmm. but carried on and kept fighting and paid for themselves to play for England and bought their own kit and defied the FA saying they couldn't play. You know, for those women, for the generations that kind of did it, not even semi-professional, you know, they held jobs down in the day, they were playing football in the evenings, they weren't welcome in football grounds. You know, I think you could really feel that history, and those lionesses have got a great sense of that as well, of their legacy. You know, I mean, the younger ones, you kind of have to, they're 23, they've just played football. They don't, you know, fully understand what's happened before. But some of the older ones have been through both generations.
Yeah.
And that was really special, I think, to really feel that history coming to the fore that day.
Yeah. I mean, there obviously has been a huge shift in attitude and in, you know, how we see women in sport in general, but specifically football, because of everything that you've just said. But it still feels disproportionately imbalanced in a way. Do you think that's going to change over the years to come?
Yeah, I think it will. I think what's happened is a realisation that, you know, you can be entertained by women's football. You know, there was always this narrative that, well, women are not going to be as strong, as quick, as skillful as, you know, all those things that were thrown. We watch plenty of sport that men and women both play and admire them. Take tennis, yeah. right? You go to the slams, you don't say, oh, I'm going to turn down a women's final ticket, because you know you're going to be entertained. It's great sport. And I think what's happened is there's been a shift in lots of people's minds and a lot of male kind of sports watchers' minds as well, which I think is really important, because both, you know, we need men and women to both enjoy women's football,
yeah.
where they realise, actually, I can be entertained by this and stop comparing it to men's football.
Yeah.
And as my husband kept saying, well, he's always loved women's football. He comes from, he was a rugby player, but he comes from a background of kind of no nonsense, you know, and he hates male footballers rolling around on the pitch pretending to be injured. And he's like, the women never do that, you know? He's like, I never see a woman doing that. They don't ever, you know, kind of do this whole drama kind of queen thing where they're pretending that they've been kicked.
No, we have periods every month. We haven't got enough shit to deal with. I'm not going to be rolling around with someone kicks in the shin. It's like, are you kidding me?
So all of that, I think, has lent itself a kind of an opportunity where people, clearly brands and, you know, corporate relationships, all those things are going to improve, because people want to be aligned to the women's game.
Absolutely.
Because of all those values. And then that will help the sport to grow. I think what happens now, what needs to happen now, if this is going to be kind of more than just a moment in time, is opportunity needs to be more widespread, you know, not just pockets in the country. If girls go to school in Devon and Cornwall and, you know, up in the Highlands and Islands, they should have the opportunity, like the boys at their school, to play football. It shouldn't be something that, just because a headmaster decides it, it should be something that is widely available to all girls.
Absolutely. I love that. At my kids' school, they've got quite a good open policy with that. There are some boys that have chosen netball over football and girls that have chosen football over netball. And that's sort of quite welcomed. And it's such a great thing to see that the younger generations won't have this strange concept of girls do one sport and boys do another. It'll be much, much more intuitive with what the individual wants to do, which is so positive.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the way the sport grew in America, and men's and women's football pretty much grew at the same rate because it came to the country at the same time.
Yeah.
And while they did have a professional male league before they did women's, women played from the start. So they never saw it as a man's sport. And does it surprise you that they are the outstanding nation in the world at football for women, you know, because they haven't had that break in history. So I think if it's just the kind of prism through which we view it, isn't it? And because we've historically gone, oh, this is something for men, you know, which is just ridiculous, isn't it? And now we can see that that's not the case, and we can enjoy it. It's like, there was a moment, I think it was the 2016 Olympics, so my son Ruben would have been about 13, and I saw him watching the women's rugby, the sevens. I came into the kitchen, he was watching it. I said, oh, I'm so proud you're watching women's sport. And he's like, it's just good sport. He did not see it as women's sevens.
Great.
Yeah. And so I think, you, like you say about the younger generation, they won't see
no.
the difference.
I mean, I was saying to Honey, who's seven, I was going, this is such an important day for women and girls. And she was like, all right, like, what are you on about? But that's a good thing. Like, we want this just to all go away and feminism not to even exist, or words of those with that meaning. That everything's just an even playing field and there's equality throughout. So it's a bloody amazing start, though, to such a big shift. It's so, so cool.
Yeah.
So let's talk about this exceptional book, The First Half. So this was written during the pandemic.
Yeah.
At a time where initially, I think like most people, you felt a slight panic, like, what the hell am I going to do? And that led to this immense moment of reflection for you to look over the first half of your life and everything that's been before. What was that process like? Because obviously you've got to face the beautiful, the big, the bold moments, but also the really tough, challenging things that you don't want to poke around in and look at.
And knowing where to start as well, you know, because I knew I wanted to write it for a long time, or something of that ilk, for a long time, and I just never had the time. And so Kenny, my husband, was like, you've got time now, just go write. You know, the kids were doing their GCSEs their first year, so they were on Zooms all day long. I didn't have that horrible stress that a lot of people had with, like, small children homeschooling. Mine were just getting on with it, yeah. So I was really lucky. I had a lot of time. Their day was 8 till 4.
Wow.
So I had a long day. I'd make lunch for everybody. We'd have these kind of ridiculous huge lunches every day, you know, because everybody, well, the kids were expecting a school dinner, you know, so I was practically doing kind of apple pie and custard.
Oh, brilliant.
And then we were all getting on with our day and working. And I had this very disciplined day, which was brilliant because it lent itself to kind of sitting down and just knuckling down and writing. But I really struggled to get going, you know, with the actual, what are the first words going to be? And so I just said to myself, well, I just write and see what happens. And so I start at quite a kind of seminal moment in my life, and then as the book kind of evolved, I wanted then to have a theme that kind of ran through and realised that sport was important in my life, but not, this is not a book about, you know, statistics and kind of match reports. It's just the way that sport has kind of empowered and also brought sadness and joy and, you know, opportunity, I think, to
and
my
a husband.
Life. And a husband, yeah. And that
handily.
Was a good opportunity. Yeah.
That was a great one. We'll get to Kenny a bit later, your wonderful husband. But as you said, you know, you had to face some seriously challenging moments, and the opening moment that you've just spoken about, a seminal moment that impacted your life and still does today, is the death of your brother, who was only a teenager at the time, completely unexpected, shook your family to the core. I mean, how was that to revisit that moment in that minutiae, that detail, to sort of sit and to really explore that time of your life?
The amazing thing was how clear everything was. You know, it was so it was about 28 years. It's just gone 30 years. So it was about 28 years it happened, since it happened. And yet I could still picture myself sitting on the bed when the phone rang, my mum telling me, and I could still picture myself that afternoon in a gym. You know, when you read the book, you'll understand why that's kind of relevant. And I could still smell through the windows the barbecues that were going on in the street where I lived, and all those things came flooding back. And so when I sent the chapter to my mum, because you don't want to get anything wrong that's so precious, you know, in that moment, she never sent back any corrections and said, you know, this didn't happen, or I didn't do this, or you didn't do that. You know, it was just very real again for me, I think. And of course, I've talked about it over the years, but never really in such detail. And I suppose you're looking at it from really the whole kind of family picture and where everybody was and what everybody, because it was a sudden death. I mean, you know, he was literally playing football one minute and he was dead the next. And, you know, at 15 years old, that's not the natural order of things. And he wasn't even playing in a football match. He was playing in the garden, and my parents were getting ready to go out for dinner, and life could not have been better or more normal, or, you know, everything in the world was good. You know, everybody was happy. And I remember my mum telling me a few months before, she'd been in Thailand on a holiday with my dad, the first time they'd gone away as a couple pretty much their whole lives. And because my youngest brother was six and I was away, had my gap year, my sister was modelling in Japan, Daniel had just got this contract to play for Leeds United, and she said there was this moment where she said to my dad, they've got their wings, they're flying. And that was kind of, you know, the beginning of the rest of their lives as well, you know, because their kids were on their way. And so it was just brutal, you know.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that, because it's, you know, I know from talking to my husband, who's, you know, he lost his mum a long time ago, that grief it undulates. It's not there constantly, but it doesn't go.
No.
It's not like talking about this stuff is easier. And I know, especially when you're writing, it has almost a different flavour when you're looking back at your past, because it's unedited, it's unfiltered. You can do it privately, intimately, so you can really get to the bones of how you feel and what that experience was like. Did you uncover anything from that process about your own grief or understand your own grief a bit better in that process?
Yeah, I think I uncovered stuff about me, but also then I started to look at what was going on with everybody else around us, and the fallout of his death is still really there in our family, you know, because it resulted eventually in divorce. And as I talk about, my dad, you know, has a problem with alcohol, and all of that was exacerbated, and other things in relationships. And so when you start to kind of write about it and unpick things, and you realise, you look back and think, my dad should have had counselling. My dad should have spoken to somebody. Why did we, you know, I mean, even us, nobody spoke to us, you know, it just wasn't the way back then.
No.
And even us as kids, but definitely my mum was on a journey. So she was searching for her own counsel, if you like, you know, and she was offering it to my dad, but he just was very reluctant. And I think nowadays that just wouldn't happen.
No.
You know, he would probably have a more of an acceptance that it's okay to talk to somebody. But then it just, you know, he was a footballer. He was a hard guy. He was this tough bloke. He was not going to sit down and open up about how he felt. Instead, he just shut himself off. And so when I started writing, I felt enormous sympathy and empathy towards him and understanding of why, you know, his life has evolved the way it has. It doesn't make it any easier, but I don't have any blame or any desire to kind of like, you know, castigate him, or you know, that's just how it was. And then also, you know, you look at your siblings and kind of how everybody deals with things is so different. So yeah, writing it down really did kind of put all those things into sharp focus. And I was so young, you know, and I look back and think, God, I was 19 years old, and this huge thing that was really going to shape my future in many ways had come along. And I didn't realize at the time, I think people say to you, does it change you? Well, at 19, you're still changing, aren't you? So you don't really know what you would have been or who you would have been. But now I look back and when I was writing and realise, of course, it massively shaped who I was and what I was going to be.
As well as that grief, did you have anxiety that followed? Because having something happen out of the blue like that you're not expecting, it might not be grief for some people, it might just be something shocking and awful. I've certainly had stuff like that happen in my life. And it's hard to not have some sort of aftermath or hangover of anxiety that you sort of carry around with you, because you don't feel safe, you don't feel grounded in everything's going to be okay, because you've had a moment where the rug has been pulled and you're almost second guessing when that's going to happen again. Have you had to deal with that?
Yeah, I definitely, it's almost the opposite, isn't it? Of kind of you then think everything isn't going to be okay.
Yeah.
And you're waiting for the next kind of disaster, or you're not wanting to love anything or anybody because they're going to get taken away from you. Or you're not wanting to really invest kind of yourself into something, because why would I bother doing that when, you know, this is... And I had two different kind of examples with my parents, because my dad was very much the glass is half empty and my mum was the glass is half full. And so, and I was trying to be kind of positive and seize the day in lots of ways, you know, making myself busy, doing everything I could to kind of have a full and, you know, great life that I was living for two or three, you know, and just rushing through life. But at the same time, not really connecting with things, you know. So I think if you rush, you don't necessarily see things, you don't necessarily breathe, you don't take things in. And so there's probably a couple of years without breathing, you know, without just going, okay, this is, you know, this is who I am. And I don't blame that 19-year-old person
coping
at all.
Yeah. You're trying to cope.
But it did all kind of come to sharp focus when I got to university. And I think it was my first year exams when I really crashed. And I was just crying on my bed, you know, and kind of on my own and feeling lost, but not wanting to show anybody who I was with at university that face. And a doctor, I went to see him, I said, I can't sleep. And he just gave me sleeping tablets without even looking at my face. You know, he didn't ask me any questions. And at that point, when I was writing, I realised I got to that stage at 20, gone through the Bradford fire as a kid, gone through my brother's death, and nobody had ever sat down and said, do you think you should go and speak to somebody about all these things that you, the trauma that you're probably carrying with you? And it was probably, and I realised that wasn't a good route to take, the sleeping tablets. So I kind of got rid of those. And then it took me a couple of years before I did meet somebody who I could, a therapist basically, who I could start to kind of unravel things. And I think it was absolutely the right time, you know, for me. I'm glad it was then, you know, my early 20s, and I didn't wait till my early 40s or my early 50s, because I think patterns of behaviour start to set in, and that can be damaging behaviour physically, emotionally, mentally. And I was really lucky to find somebody who could help me kind of make sense of everything.
I mean, you talk about some very important people in your life who have helped you heal, helped guide you since. One of them is Ed Percival.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a bit about him, how he helped you? I know it was more professionally, but that's obviously spilled into how you live your actual life as well.
So when I went to Sky, I was in local radio for a year after university, and then I had this really kind of sliding doors moment and ended up at Sky Sports within about a month of leaving. Well, I hadn't even left the radio. I was thinking I need to get to London somehow for my career, and then ended up at Sky a month later. It was kind of very fortuitous. And Sky were employing a lot of new presenters. They hadn't really had many women on screen. And they had this guy who was going to come in and help train us all to present. But he was a neuro-linguistic processing kind of guy. And that was his background. He was actually a background in, I think back in the day, he'd been a car salesman. Then he worked for British Basketball Association. He had all these different hats he'd worn. And when I met Ed, he was probably in his mid to late 50s. And there was I, kind of 22 years old, you know, thinking that I'd arrived. I was in London. I was working for Sky Sports. And he kind of I don't know, something with him, and we connected, you know. So he was doing his job with me, which was to help me learn to present and how to, you know, to behave on camera. But he was also a very avuncular kind of character, almost paternalistic in terms of a life guide, you know, and just being. And he introduced me to a woman called Wendy Mandy, who's an acupuncturist.
Who I love.
Who I then started seeing, and she was the therapist I spoke to. So it was through Ed I met Wendy. And he wasn't, I'd said to him, oh, my skin's really bad. I used to have a bit of acupuncture when I was in Newcastle. And he said, oh, I know a really good acupuncturist. And I thought I was going to Wendy to have a few needles stuck in me. And, you know, she'd walk out the door and make herself a cup of tea. I didn't know how she operated and how she worked. And yeah, and so I had a completely different experience. And it was a talking therapy, really, and an amazing, enlightening experience. But Ed stayed kind of as part of my, you know, life almost. Through, I left Sky after 2 years, but Ed came to our wedding. He used to help Kenny a lot. He was always there for me in big moments. I'd call him and just for reassurance, or just we'd have a discussion about something to do with performance. And he was one of those people that, you know, you look back and somebody occasionally puts a hand out for you in life, don't they? And they kind of pull you through and guide you to another place. And Ed was that person. And if his wife Val is listening to this, she'll be, I think, imagine by now she'd probably be shedding a tear, because I think she knows how much I loved Ed and we loved Ed. And his family, you know, had a very special man. And when he left way too soon, you know, he was too young. I can't tell you, you don't realise what a hole somebody like that leaves in your life. It was really... it's been nearly 10 years, I think. And I keep saying to Kenny, I want to ring Ed about this. Do you know what I mean? It's, you know, those people that you just...
But it's like that mentorship, isn't it? Like having someone where there's almost clear boundaries of what I can ask you for. And if you can't facilitate that, then it's absolutely fine. But having someone that you know will give you advice that isn't based on their own nostalgia or
their own interest.
Their own interest, their own emotion. It's just, this is what I believe is categorically right for you. And amazing that he introduced you to Wendy Mandy, who I think I've talked about on this podcast before, I'm sure. She contributed to a book that I wrote last year. And she's just an incredible woman. For anyone intrigued as to what she does, she's a shaman. But there's lots involved in that process with acupuncture and reflexology and rattles and all sorts of very interesting sort of practices that she uses.
Yeah, and if you saw Ed, you would not think he and Wendy.
Really? Yeah.
Ed was a suited kind of bloke. Mm. You know, Wendy is, you know, incredibly kind of glamorous, you know, blonde hair, but very kind of hippie kind of style of dress. You know, she looks just like she's walked off a beach in Ibiza.
She's,
you know,
amazing.
She'll wear bright kind of caftans, and, you know, and Ed was this kind of quite somber dressed bloke, you know, and so you'd not think that their worlds would collide, but they adored each other. And and I, at our wedding, along with a guy called Kevin Lidler, who's this incredible physio, I called it the guru's table, because they were kind of people who fixed us between Kenny and myself. You know, these were the people who kind of kept us going and fixed us. And I think it's really important to, that's what the book gave me a really lovely opportunity to do, actually, was to talk about that. Because the idea that we go through life, you know, kind of we wake up beautiful, we, you know, we don't have to work out. We don't have to. This is nonsense, isn't it? You know, yeah. we all have to kind of do exercise. We have to kind of put yeah. a bit of effort into whether it's the exterior, and we also have to put effort into the interior. You know, yes. it doesn't just happen. You know, peace and tranquility and balance doesn't. You don't just wake up feeling
no.
great.
And so, also that we shouldn't have to plough through whether it is trauma or it is just the day to day. Being a broadcaster or whatever you're trying to achieve in life or professionally, that we should just be stoic and push through things on our own. It's really important where you can. It doesn't have to be someone you pay necessarily, but it could be a friend, a mentor that you have in your life that you can lean on, that you can ask advice and that you can get comfort and solace from people. I think it's really important that's promoted as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, and I also think now I kind of, because I've always been, because I was so young at Sky, I've always been slightly reluctant to admit that I'm a grown-up in you know, because I was so young there. I was on telly, I was 22, and now I am definitely the old person in the room. You know, when I'm most TV shows, I go, oh, God, look at all these children I'm working with. Mm-hmm. And so now it's my turn to do that, you yeah. know. And I, whether it's young presenters who ask my advice or, you know, I try and, if people contact me on social media, it's not always easy to kind of reply to everybody in terms of how did you get to where you got to, which is in a way why the book is going to be very useful, because I can say, read this, you'll understand
yeah, yeah,
kind of where
yeah,
I got
yeah.
to. But also just giving people, even if it's half an hour on Zoom, like, you know, I get students quite a lot who are writing thesis on women in sport and things like that. And I always try and do that because I know how much of a difference it made to me when people helped me. And and so time is, you know, the most valuable commodity, isn't it, that we've all got. And sometimes we don't have enough time, but actually just that half an hour can really change somebody's yeah. Journey and their kind
whole
of process.
Whole career path could be changed yeah. because you've encouraged them or they've even believed, oh, that is possible for me.
Yeah.
Like, I'm talking to Gabby Logan. This is a possibility. You know, it's a huge, huge deal. I'm really interested with your introduction into broadcasting, because obviously you were a gymnast as a teenager at a very, very high competitive level. And it was a trip to the Blue Peter studio that really piqued your curiosity about, wow, these cameras and all of this excitement and buzz. What was going on for you that day when you walked into the studio? How did it feel? What made you want to pursue that and continue down that path?
It was really mind-blowing. Going in, a girl from Leeds, right, coming down the train, going into those studios, which you've
the
worked
best.
On a million times,
yeah.
right? And I'm still
now flat yeah. in a Soho house. Let's not talk about that.
And I'm so sad. I still, you know, I'm so sad that I have to go to Salford to do something like Match of the Day when I used to be 25 minutes down the road. But never mind that part of it. This was a building that was possibility, the endless possibility.
Yeah.
You know, everything from the news at 10 to Doctor Who to French and Saunders was filmed. You know, so many shows in between. And Blue Peter came from there, which at the time was twice a week, live telly, 5 o'clock. It would
Huge.
Get millions.
Huge.
You know, it was millions. And so me and another gymnast were asked to open the show to the Blue Peter music. And then Yvette Fielding, who was one of the presenters at the time, was going to try out some moves. And it was all to advertise a competition that we were doing at Wembley. So I kind of walked into this building with, I'd seen it on telly like almost every Saturday, whether I was watching, you know, what was it? Zoe's show.
Oh, Live and Kicking.
Live and Kicking.
Yeah.
All the Saturday morning shows used to come from there. And so I was in this building, you know, that in itself was mind blowing.
Yeah.
And then we went into makeup, which of course we were 15. We were in there for about 3 seconds. And they, but this was a proper old makeup
yeah.
room, you know, with like rows of, you know, you just don't have them anymore, wig makers and everything going on in there. And it was just so intoxicating. And then we go in the studio, a massive studio with all these lights rigged up and these cameras. And it was just mind blowing to me. I'd never seen anything like this. And we did the performance and everything. And I walked away that day thinking, that's what I want to do. That's
yeah.
I want to be in that environment. I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I want to be in that environment. So I wrote to the editor. And he very kindly wrote back to the British Gymnastics Association and this lovely letter to me and told me to go to university, basically. He said, you know, go and get your studies done. And it wasn't really filled with loads of advice, but it was just kind of him to actually take the time. And then years later, when I worked for ITV, he owned a production company. He'd left Blue Peter. And I walked on set doing this health and fitness program, and he was the editor of the
That's
show.
That's so wonderful.
And he said, so you took my advice then.
So lovely.
I know.
But I know that feeling. So I remember certainly, well, I joined the BBC when I don't know, I was about 19 maybe. And that feeling of, oh, this is where it all happens. And you would quite literally see like Hugh Grant walking down one corridor because he'd
yeah.
be filming something in French and Saunders, and then Mr. Blobby on
yeah,
the next.
Yeah.
And you'd go, oh my God, and you'd bump into people in the canteen, in the bar. And it was so, so, so exciting. What I find remarkable is that the downside of our industry has in no way deterred you? Because I've been massively put off to the point where I don't really do it much anymore. Like, I'm very happy in my little garden, in my little shed, talking to people. I've created a little safety bubble for myself where I can create stuff that I really believe in. And if people like it, amazing. If it's not their cup of tea, I'm completely not offended. But I find being in the environment of, you know, your, you know, say you're on ITV or BBC, wherever, working for a network, and it's not yours. You are hired mm-hmm. by somebody else, and that you are there to do a job mm-hmm. and to do it to the best of your ability with no margin for error, with then commentary from the outside world yeah. coming at you. I've got to a point, and it might change, I don't know, down the line, but I'm in a place now in my life where I can't do that. I'm definitely not up for it. I'm not strong enough to be in that environment. I can dip in and out. But to have that as my main thing, I would crumble if I was still doing it. And I think I was resilient enough as maybe a teen and in my early 20s to not really pay much attention to it. And there was no social media, so I could kind of get on with it.
Yeah.
But that, thank God, has not put you off, because we need you on the telly doing what you do. But I'm interested to understand what your resilience is made of and where it comes from and how you're able to cope in that environment. And I might sound dramatic to some people, but that's the experience of it for
me.
It's
yeah.
really hostile.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, people on social media have seconds. They don't even think about it
no.
when they're sending their opinion on something that you've either done,
yeah.
worn, said, trying to correct you for something. You know, back in the day when I first started out, they had to write a letter. So they didn't bother.
No one could be asked.
No, I mean, the kind of letters I got were usually a bit strange and, you know, contained things like sachets of coffee and half-eaten chocolates.
And things, yeah.
And so when social media started and was a thing, I describe it in the book as kind of like a Pandora's box. I remember putting my name into the internet, stupidly. I mean, I don't think I've ever done it since, right?
Never.
And honestly, I was, apparently I've got really masculine hands, and I've got apparently my hair looks like a lion. And I like
you've got gorgeous.
And I remember looking at myself and seeing something different, because this is the way other people are seeing me. And Kenny, being, you know, ever the kind of, like, you know, pragmatic and sensible, kind of just said, that's just a load of nonsense. Forget it, you know. But of course, there are times when you take things a bit more personally than you should, and I had to ride through a period where, you know, I let it affect me a bit too much. And something happened in my career where I kind of was effectively ousted from ITV. You know, I'd lost, you know, I didn't lose my job per se, but I was being demoted from frontline presenting on football by a boss who came and didn't like me. That's fine. Not everybody has to like everybody. And at that point, I was just, OK, I've had enough of this. I want to be in control of my life. I don't want to be at the whim of somebody else's kind of, you know, opinions. And I was all ready to kind of jack it in then. My babies were a year old. I was going through, imagine having, you know, you've got a year old twins, you're going through
imagine.
Kind of all of that.
Well, already after having a baby, you've sort of like,
you start reevaluating.
Who am I? Yeah. I don't know what I want, and you feel a bit lost, and your confidence isn't quite as brilliant. I mean, it's not for everybody, but I think most of my friends I've spoken to definitely felt the same, that you do lose a bit of your confidence and you're knackered, your energy levels are just naturally lower. So that is a tough time anyway.
And it was a really, really tough period. And then the BBC asked me to go and screen test for a show that they wanted to do, which was kind of like it was going to be the news night of sport, they called it. It was called Inside Sport. And they offered me that, and they offered me a contract and an opportunity to go and almost kind of rebuild myself. And I had to kind of go back to square one in lots of ways, and because I didn't know anybody there. I'd have a really comfy time at ITV, you know, for 8 years. I was getting the top jobs. I was doing great things. I had lovely colleagues. I'd met my husband. I thought that's my life was kind of going in that trajectory, and it was never going anywhere else. And I look back now and realise that that period was so important, you know, and I talk to my kids about it all the time. I talk to people in sport. The disappointments and the times when things don't go so well, the bumps in the road, they're so important in terms of your, just the character that you have to kind of draw on, the resilience that you're going to acquire. And I think if I hadn't gone through that, maybe I would have also at some point kind of decided to retreat, I think. But actually going to the BBC, having to kind of impress new people and really, you know, earn my spurs with them, because they didn't know if they could trust me. They didn't want to just throw me into Match of the Day if they didn't know me. And all of that, I think, was actually really rewarding. And I'm so glad that I did stick it out, because the stuff I love, doing things like the Olympics or the Euros, you know, is so rewarding and so enjoyable. And I would have missed out on those things. But I think then you do start to make better decisions, or I start to make better decisions about stuff. I don't need to put myself in that situation, or you kind of learn to trust yourself and your judgment. I think that's the other thing that comes through that early mothering period, you know, when you start making decisions that are, is that going to take me away from home when I don't need to be?
Yeah.
I'm not doing it. I'm going to do this. And being stronger about saying no to people, you know, for things that previously you felt you had to people please or you had to go the extra mile for them. So it was in some ways the best of times and the worst of times, you know. And there was a thrown into the mix of that as well was a horrible period which we basically were phone hacked and we didn't know. And so there was all sorts of weird stuff going on in our personal lives that, you know, we had journalists banging on the door, accusing us of things that we had. It was all very, it was
awful.
One of those odd periods of your life where you look back and go,
it makes me panic to think about it, Gabby.
And we had two babies in our arms,
awful.
You know. I remember one time opening the door and we had a baby each in an arm on a Saturday afternoon and some journalist telling us something that hadn't happened. And us going for a walk afterwards and you start second guessing, kind of like, what's going on? Where's all this stuff coming from? And it was a strange period. There was a lot of stuff, you know, that kind of I wish hadn't happened.
Yeah.
It would have been lovely to have had a smooth trajectory through, you know, ITV. But I honestly think I'm better at what I do because of that. And so, yeah.
And also, I think you end up going off on tangents that you weren't expecting, because we all hope for an easy, smooth ride and it to be an ascent to somewhere. But actually, you end up going down a really interesting path when, you know, that's why I do all of this stuff. I guess I'd completely sort of hit rock bottom in ways. And it was like, oh, I need to do something completely different. And I wouldn't have. I would probably still be trying to be the best presenter I could possibly be and sort of, I don't know, ruining my sanity in the long run. So I think
the thing as well that I'm lucky about with sport is that there's a lot of older men who've been doing this for a long time. So I've always felt to myself, do you know what? They can't kick me out here for being too old, because I'll still always be 12 years younger than Gary Lineker, whatever happens. So
sorry about that, Gary. Yeah. It's a fact.
But, you know, and Gary does a great job. Mm. But I think in lots of other areas of telly, I see it with some of my girlfriends, you know, there's a kind of paranoia about, am I now past my sell-by date?
Oh, that still exists,
you know?
for women.
Yeah.
That still exists.
Yeah. And I've always kind of got, okay, I am 50 next year, right? There's no denying it. That's it. That's it's a fact, you know. I'm going to have to kind of embrace that and carry on working, because I never thought, Fern, I'd be on telly at this age.
Really?
I had a boss at Sky who told me I'd be off his screen by the time I was 28.
That's nice.
Yeah. And then I then thought in my head, 40 if I'm lucky. You know, I honestly had these kind of lines in the sand that I couldn't believe I'd still be working. And now I feel like I'll do it for as long as I'm kind of feeling like I can.
People want knowledgeable, wise, you know, accomplished presenters. Why on earth would you not be sticking around until the moment that you're ready to walk away?
And there are some really good role models now as well, I think, in broadcasting, you know, whose wisdom and whose, you know, kind of, I mean, you look at Newsnight, I just mentioned it as a in dispatches with regard to a sports programme, but somebody like Kirsty Walk, who's still there anchoring Newsnight, you know, into her 60s. And I think the landscape is changing for women in broadcasting. And I think what's acceptable in terms of getting rid of people, you know, just because how many times have we seen over the years those partnerships, on-screen partnerships, where the woman is always 25 years younger than the man,
yes.
You know? And I think there's, you know, that is turning a little bit. So, and hopefully, as I say, I'll be able to work a bit longer.
Oh, no, you just have to keep on going. But, I mean, how did you find, I mean, I've obviously read about this in the book, but I'm keen to know how you dealt with the misogyny that you had to go through and experience starting in sports TV. Because obviously, I just sort of did traditional broadcasting and there was still an element back in the day of sort of misogyny and how women were treated and how you would have to dress and, you know, to be accepted as a female TV host. But I think there's a whole other underbelly of that within the sports world. How did you navigate
that?
Yeah,
it really does draw out the dinosaurs. I mean, you know, it's incredible the kinds of things that people would say to me on social media or, you know, even newspaper articles. I remember a particular newspaper doing this piece when I was, this is early 2000, so I've been doing it for a few years at this point, and saying how it was disgraceful that women were allowed to invade this landscape because it was the last bastion. It was like the last place. And now if they were there, then where else, you know, could a man go? And kind of, and this was like 2000, you know. And
I don't have any words.
No, and I was just reading it like, this is ridiculous. But obviously, the stuff that really kind of, you know, can sometimes hurt you and you feel a little bit more shifted by is kind of, you know, when people say, slanderous or kind of, you know, mean and nothing to do with what you're doing. It's just to do with the way you look or the way you, the fact you're a woman, yeah, and the sexual kind of, you know, slights and things like that, that you just feel like, this is ridiculous. You know, yeah, this is nothing to do with what I'm doing. So, of course, at the beginning, I was like, right, I'm going to be the best that I can possibly be so that nobody can criticise me, you know. So you're trying to kind of not make any mistakes and be. And I remember an old boss who was a brilliant ally, a guy called Brian Barwick at ITV, he said, you don't have to load all your questions with so many facts, because I was trying too hard to prove I knew things. You know, he said, I know you know it. I wouldn't be employing you if you didn't. Just, you know, less is more. And don't be afraid just to ask the simple questions. And I think, but there's, you know, as women, it's like proving that I'm supposed, yeah, to be in this place, and I'm not, you know, I'm not a charlatan. I'm not some kind of, you know, I'm not some fly-by-night person that's not going to commit to the job. And sports viewers are quite discerning like that. They like to know their facts. They like to tell you when you've got things wrong. And I understand that, because it's passion and they love what they're watching. But there have been times where it's crossed a line and it's not acceptable.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Let's talk about Kenny. We haven't got to Kenny yet. Your lovely husband, who is, I've met him a handful of times. We've chatted on the phone weirdly about dyslexia and ADHD and all sorts of things that he's been sort of helping me learn about, which has been very, very handy. But that part of the book was so lovely. Like your fateful meeting your husband in a famous bar in London. And that sort of, that nearly didn't, another sliding doors moment, yeah, nearly didn't happen. Yeah. But that again, like changing the course of your life.
Yeah. And I did not, I was at that point in my kind of mid-20s where I'd had enough of, you know, dodgy blokes and things that weren't working out. And I'd made a categorical decision the New Year's Eve, about 3 weeks before, I'm not having any more relationships. I'm not going out with any dodgy blokes. I'm going to just focus on me and have a nice time and my lovely girlfriends. And I was out with my good friend Kirsty Gallagher's birthday and another girlfriend. We were leaving early because it was about 1 a.m, which was early back in the day, you know, and we were like, let's have an early night. And just as we're driving down to Fulham Road, she said, should we just nip in for one to a bar called the K Bar? And I was like, oh, Tamsin, come on, let's get home. And somehow at 10 to 2 in the morning, the bouncer was like, not going to let us in, because he was like, we're closing in 10 minutes. And somebody I knew was walking behind the bouncer and said, let them in. And so there were so many barriers to my kind of being in that bar that night. And then Tamsin worked at Sky and she knew all the rugby guys because she worked in the rugby department. She went, oh, I did a big piece with those guys last week. They're all Wasp players. So she just went over and chatted to them. I didn't. And then a guy I knew wanted to buy me a drink and Kenny kind of muscled over and took the drink off him. And
yes,
and I was, we just had such a lovely chat. And he's got a, you know, great Scottish accent and I was enjoying his voice and kind of listening to him. And that was it. And he kind of walked off. And then apparently he told his friends he was chatting Gabby Roslin up around the corner. And his mate, said, no, you pillock. That's not Gabby Roslin. That's Gabby who does the sport on the ITV. And he came back and went, do you know what? And he kind of told me his faux pas. And then the next thing, we were in this 24-hour cafe till like 4 a.m, having breakfast, just chatting. And you know when you meet somebody and you think, I could just keep chatting to you forever and ever. And that was kind of the beginning of, you know, what is now a 21-year marriage. So it was all very fateful. We knew so many people in each other's worlds, but we'd never actually met. You know, there were loads of people. We even worked for, not worked for, but we were patrons of the same charity, but we just hadn't been to the same charity events. This charity called Sparks, which was research into childhood diseases. We both did loads of their events and there's loads of things that we lived about half a mile from each other. It was really weird that our worlds hadn't yet collided. But yeah,
I love sliding doors moments are my absolute faves.
I mean, I was walking back to the cab when the bouncer said no. I said to the cab, hang on, I'm coming. And Tamsin obviously was desperate for one more glass of white wine and was like, no, we're going in. So, yeah.
Oh, it's so wonderful. It's a magical moment. I really want to talk to you about cold water as well, because the whole sort of last section of the book is very much dedicated to cold water, yeah, therapy, and something that I'm deeply interested in myself. I mean, we could do with it today because, yeah, it's about 8 million degrees in this little box that we're recording in. But obviously you went on the Wim Hof show and did a whole bunch of crazy challenges that pushed you to your absolute limits. I'm wondering, is that something that you still use regularly to help? How does it help? How are you using
cold
it?
Cold showers, definitely. Yeah. Although in the summer, you can't get your shower to go cold enough.
No.
You really can't. In fact, in this country, compared to what they were like in Northern Italy, even in the middle of winter, our showers are nowhere near as cold as the showers we were having there. But we were doing more than showers. We were jumping in ice lakes and everything else. So yeah, definitely. And Kenny's a real convert to it as well. He said he feels he's cheated if he hasn't had a cold shower in the morning, you know, but he's very loud about it, you know. I'm in the bedroom and I can hear him going,
that's like Jesse.
Are you having your cold shower, Kenny?
Yeah, well done.
So I'm definitely a convert to that. In fact, you know, my son as well, he's really into it. I didn't even know Ruben was doing the breathing, the Wim Hof breathing, before I even knew anything about the show. And I spoke to the family, kind of family meeting, you know, I'm thinking of doing this show, because you like to get the kind of approval of everybody and you don't want to put them in a situation where they, oh God, my mother's going off to do a show where she's going to be jumping in a lake in a swimsuit and she's nearly 50, what's she thinking? And he was like, oh yeah, I do his breathing. I was like, what? And he said, yeah, it really helps me if I feel anxious. And it does. The breathing is amazing.
Yeah.
And the reason, partly I wanted to do the show because I wanted to push myself somewhere, but also I felt like breathing and cold water therapy are free. So it was something I felt I could talk about afterwards and not feel like I was saying, join this community. It's going to cost you £1,000. You know, it doesn't cost a thing.
No.
So everybody can have a cold shower and everybody can learn to breathe. And everybody should.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because Wim has obviously become completely synonymous with cold water, but the breathing is more important almost.
Yeah, it is, I think.
And I know that, you know, you describe in great detail the first time you did that breathing as a group and a whole load of emotion came up and you kind of, all inhibition was lost, you just kind of went for it. And I haven't had the pleasure of sort of sitting with Wim himself and doing that technique, but I've worked with other breath therapists where you're intensely doing a certain breath sequence for very long periods of time. And it's the craziest experience. You're almost not in your physical body. I've certainly had sort of tingling sensation in my hands and feet and sometimes quite tense arms that sort of end up here in a sort of fetal position, tears, all sorts of emotion, sometimes hysterical laughter. It taps into, it's almost therapy without talking. It taps into something and brings it out
it's
of you.
The most incredible, first breathing session was one of the most incredible moments of my life.
And you had visions, didn't you, as well?
Yeah, I had. I think he did, I don't know how many rounds in the end he did, but like say you would normally do 3 or 4 rounds of breathing, I think we might have got close to 10, you know, so we were so deep into this. And you can imagine you're being filmed, but I promise you, totally unaware of the cameras on top of your head because we were so deep into these meditative breathing exercises. And I was already having very physical kind of, I went freezing cold and then I was getting tingly and then I was seeing a lot of male stuff, like it was my son and my brother and things like that. And I thought that was going to be the end of it, you know, that it was just this. And then I had this overwhelming feeling of love, like if love was a tangible thing, it was all over me. And I stood up and I looked at Tamsin Althway and I just went over to him, burst into tears, and I said, your mum's here and I've just got to give you all this love. And I think look back now, I think I sound completely mad, you know, but it was, I had to say it, you know, it was like, I've never experienced anything like it. And every time I had something, not as profound as that, because we didn't go as deep, every time I had something quite incredible. And the times I've done it at home since, what's happened is I just, an hour disappears. I can go into the breathing and I'll say to Kenny, we're going out tonight, I'm feeling a bit tired, I'm going to do 15 minutes of breathing. Suddenly it's an hour. And he's like, you've got to get ready, we're going.
That's so good that you just kept it up.
Yeah, I think the breathing is, like you say, I think it's probably more powerful than the cold water. The cold water's invigorating and undoubtedly has effects on people with, you know, anxiety and definitely can help people to kind of lower stress levels and is nuts to swim under. Ice. I mean, that is just...
I felt sick reading that bit of the book where you're swimming, was it 4 metres under?
Yeah, yeah.
No.
I'd seen people do it on telly.
No.
That's mad.
No.
I'd never do that.
No,
and then
the
next thing, I was under... And I didn't have as profound an experience as Wim was promising us for that one. He kept saying, you'll see things, but other people did. So that for me was just a cold water challenge. For Chelsea Grimes, it was like a baptism. It's like an awakening.
Wow.
Because she met her 4-year-old self under the water. And it was just everybody had very different experiences. And I think it shows kind of, you know, that it's not one size fits all. Some things will really connect with some people, and or when you're ready to have those moments, I think. But the breathing is, for me, the kind of big awakening for the next part of my life, and something I'll definitely keep doing and try and encourage my kids to.
And like you say, it's free. We can all do it. I mean, none of us are really breathing properly day to day anyway. We'll either hold our breath, we'll have a really short, shallow breath, or we'll hold it down low, or we're just breathing really quickly up here and it's causing all sorts of stress and anxiety. But to do an actual practice where it is sort of more meditative, it's extraordinary to realise the depths you can go to. And and that's available to us at any one time. And then we can get caught up in all the other stuff that we probably talked about today with, you know, comparing yourself to other people or worrying what other people think of you or what's going on at work. It's extraordinary that that's always down there. It's always at another layer, and we can reach it. We can access that, and we can help to heal ourselves and help to, you know, move through difficult, challenging times. It's, I mean, I'm sort of saying it's almost convinced myself to do it more because I either get out of the habit, or sometimes with the really deep sort of breathing where you have a gorgeous experience like you've just described, I think, oh my God, it's such hard work. I don't think I can go into that again because it is such a physical workout.
I mean,
almost.
It was really, really profound. Like the rest of the day, I felt like I'd been somewhere. Like I felt like I'd been to another country. Yeah. You know, I was almost like a jet lagged feeling, and it forged a really lovely connection with Tamsin, who I didn't know before. And you know, now you know, we'll text. We don't see each other enough, but you know, we'll text and stuff. And because I think, when you've gone through something like that, you can't undo that.
No.
And and her dad, even he'd said to her when she rang home, because obviously they'd got word back of how everybody was getting on. They were calling our families, and he said, "I hear Gabby saw your mum," and you know, and that brought me to tears because they weren't together when she died, but obviously he had great love for her. And so I think the fact that there was no doubt in their minds, because the kind of woman that she was, you know, that she would have, if she could have made herself known to her, she would be there. And Tamsin's worry about doing the show was because her mum died suddenly, that the cold water might bring on some kind of, you know, aneurysm or something might happen to her. So she had these doubts about it. But like the rest of us, came through the experience absolutely with no regrets. I mean, it was I don't know why I said yes in a way. Do you know, when you look back and you think, what was I thinking? But I'm so glad I did.
Oh, it's such an experience. I mean, it was a beautiful bit of the book to read because it just seemed transformative. And like you say in the book, a perfect, not moment of closure, but a marker of that halfway point you're talking about, that you had those sort of realizations and visualizations, and you've been able to reflect on
and acceptance.
The first time. And acceptance.
You know, because you kind of talk about, you know, comparing ourselves and all those things. And genuinely, as I sit here on the precipice of the kind of half century, those things definitely can be dealt with. You know, I don't feel like the need to do that anymore. I don't want to kind of, I want friends that I love, not that I want to compete with or that you feel like you have to keep up with, you know, and trying to kind of move through life with a little bit of a more graceful pace and not, you know, not be too rushed and try and, you know, really hold on to the precious moments. And I think that's where that experience kind of cemented all of those things that you know deep down.
I mean, acceptance is one of the most important things. So hard to sometimes land on acceptance because cognitively, you know, we're trying to work things out and be pragmatic and, you know, we want a sort of a sequence. Well, I do. I'm a Virgo. I want everything to be sort of linear and to work. And sometimes you do just have to go, this is shit or this was really hard or whatever, and land on acceptance. Have you been able to find acceptance with the more challenging parts of life, with grief, with perhaps, you know, your dad's addictions that you talk about in the book? Have you found acceptance around those tough parts?
Yeah, I think so, because as I said at the very beginning, I can understand where he is, you know, and I feel for him that he misses out on his grandchildren and, you know, lots of great things that we could all do together as a family. But no family is without its challenges, you know. There is no such thing, and that's the acceptance as well. There's no such thing as this kind of great big, you know, extended family where there are no problems and everybody. That idea is, you know, is quite fanciful, really, isn't it? And you work through those things. I think you talk about kind of life as a, you know, seeing life as a linear thing. I think as a younger person, I always used to think when this happens, life will be good. When this happens, we'll all be okay. And then you realise it's just going to be a continuum. There's a flow, and you have to kind of ride with it. And I think that is part of the process of kind of understanding and accepting, say, what, you know, what my dad lives with and what might come down the path, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And what might come at us.
I really appreciated that part of the book when you were talking about your dad, because we've touched on addictions on the podcast, but more so with a person dealing with addictions. Mm. But I think for family members, friends, people in your close circle, you do feel hopeless. I mean, I'm married to someone that has been clean now for 10 years, but has struggled with addiction over the years. And we've talked about it a hell of a lot. Mm. And of course, you end up then meeting people who have got a similar situation, whether it's a partner, a mum, a dad. And it comes with its own set of responsibilities and challenges and things that you need to work through.
Well, I think the thing is, as a child, and that the reason why I wanted to write about it was because I think as a child of an addict, there's always a point in your life where you think, oh, I'm not good enough. I need to, you know, I'm not lovable enough for that person to stop that damaging behaviour. And you might be the partner of somebody. And that is an important acceptance. You know, and it took me a long time to get there. But to go, there's nothing about me that is so bad I can't be loved because I'm, you know, because I'm causing this behaviour, or I'm not helping to stop this behaviour, and it's not about me. And then when you get to that point, I think it's really where you can have healthy relationships, actually, and yeah, you can grow. Because, of course, you know, I would, from an absolutely kind of selfish point of view, I'd love him to be with us more and do things with us, but that's not going to happen. So I can't, you know, I can't change that.
Mm, I mean, that's the most difficult bit, knowing that when somebody is in addiction, you are out of control. You cannot fix them or save them or force them or have an intervention where you force somebody to change their direction in life. Mm. It very much has to be when the time is right for them. You know, I was keen to talk about that section of the book because I think there'll be so many people out there who will be related to or love dearly somebody who is struggling with addiction. And I think you do feel very alone. Obviously, there are setups like Al-Anon that you can be part of a group, and hopefully that brings you some sort of connection or to feel less alone. But I think for a lot of people out there, it does feel like it's never going to change and nothing's ever going to get better. But I think, again, we land on acceptance and that goodwill and hope and prayers.
And you just have to keep letting them know that you love them.
Yeah.
And they could do with that what they like. But it's not, you know, it's not your job at the end to turn them around. When they want to reach out for help, if you can be there, great. But understand that they might change their mind, you know, and they might let you down if that's the way you kind of perceive it. And I think you do get to a point where you go, okay, I'm going to protect myself now, and I've got to move on.
Yeah, you have to. But I thought it was a really brave thing to write about and a really beautiful thing to write about, you know, like the rest of the book. I loved reading it. It took me about 4 days. I couldn't put it down. I was just literally romping through it. It's so brilliant. And thank you. I loved talking to you today, Gabby. It was a joy.
Thank you for having me on your incredibly successful and brilliant podcast in your absolutely lovely garden shed.
Really hot shed.
Glamorous garden shed that's about 900 degrees.
I've got sweaty upper lip, my ribs, like every part of me. We'll cut there and we'll just chuck up. We're just going to do a Wim Hof. Go jump in the fridge or something. Oh, thanks, Gabby.
Thank you.
900 degrees was honestly an understatement. We had to peel ourselves off the chairs after that chat, but it was so worth it. I loved being able to talk to Gabby, especially, as I said, about the other side of addiction, being the person having to watch someone you love go through it. It's incredibly tough, so I really appreciated that part of the book and the conversation today. Thank you so much to Gabby. Her book, The First Half, is out on October the 13th. Well, I'll be back next week with another gorgeous guest. So if you're not already, make sure you are following Happy Place on your podcast feed so you can join us for that one. And if you want more Happy Place chat in the meantime, come and join our community. Come and say hello on Instagram at Happy Place Official. We absolutely love hearing what you're doing to look after yourself. Until next time, a huge thanks again to Gabby, to the producer Anushka Tate at Rethink Audio, and to you. I love you very much. Chat soon.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.